Hello, everyone. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode number 125. It's going to go up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, eBooks, YouTube, my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com. In the episode section, there is a link to my new podcast host, and it'll be on libertarianinstitute.org in the blog and the podcast section. I want to remind you that I wrote two books, Freedom Through Memedom and The Kids Are Not All Right. They are available on Amazon. If you search Mance Rader, you will see both of them. They are also available on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store, and they are only available for cryptocurrency on the website. I want to give a shout out to a couple other podcasts that I listen to on a regular basis, The Rollo and Slappy Show, Jen the Libertarian, and the Friends Against Government podcast. Those are three that I do not miss on a weekly basis, and if you listen to them, I think you will realize why they get my time during the week. Today, I am welcoming Dr. Ron Paul. Dr. Ron Paul ran for president in 1988 on the Libertarian Party ticket. In 2008 and 2012, he ran for president as a Republican. A lot of people that I know, including myself, are where they are ideologically today because we heard Ron Paul speak. Dr. Paul served in the House of Representatives. He became known as Dr. No. He would vote no on any bill that was presented that he thought was against the Constitution. I had a very short time with Dr. Paul, so I tried to ask as many meaty questions as I could. Even though this is an abbreviated episode, I think you will get a lot out of it. So, without any further delay, here is my interview with Dr. Ron Paul. I'm here with Dr. Ron Paul. How are you doing today, Dr. Paul?
I'm doing fine. Nice to be with you.
Thank you for coming on. I appreciate it. My first question, I'm sure you've heard this many times before. I'm where I am today ideologically because I saw you in a 2000 national debate take a contrary position to the mainstream. You'd been saying this for years on C-SPAN, and I'm sure you met opposition when you would say it on the House floor, but the reaction that the folks on that stage took was remarkable to me. Do you believe their reaction was caused by a very real ideology on their part, or were they just towing the party line and they didn't want that message to be blasted out to millions without trying to destroy its validity?
Well, I don't think they want to hear the truth. I don't think they agree with me, but they're annoyed that their other people might. So instead of being serious and refuting what I see, you know, whether it has to do with foreign policy or economic policy, what they need, what they feel like they have to do is destroy me as a person that's, you know, delivering a message. So that happens all the time. It continues to happen because they will not meet you on the grounds of an intellectual debate. And I think it's the way most politicians are. They aren't very serious people. They're serious about anticipating how to raise money and how to get reelected. But that's a consequence of the system that we have. That's you know, a natural consequence of a government that gets way involved. And you know, money is what talks. And the worst kind of people really go to Washington for the wrong reason. And yet they brainwash themselves. They really convince themselves that they're looking after the interests of the people, and they sort of, you know, put their blinders on. They don't admit to themselves, you know, really what I'm doing is I'm kowtowing to the lobbyists, the people who raise the money. So I think when it came to those campaigns, it was a mixture of things. They didn't want to hear me. Most of the time they can just ignore me, but when you get a position on a stage like that, they can't do that, so they have to mock you or make fun, but they do not debate. You know, it's always to mock and to criticize the individual. You know, this is crazy. You know, this, what is this stuff about getting rid of the Fed? You know, that's their attitude. But I think ideas are very powerful and they have consequences. So I'm a strong believer that if you just keep saying the thing over and over again, there's going to be a few people that are going to listen. And one person who's converted to seriously thinking along these lines is worth about 500 of those other ones that are just reciting, you know, the pablum that they've been given in their college courses and what they hear on television.
You made the comment that you think a lot of the people that go up there are deluded into believing that they're going up there for the right reasons. And from what I know of your history, I believe you went up there for the right reasons. How many other people did you meet up there that you felt like maybe they went up there genuinely for the right reasons, but they just got caught up, they just got stuck in the swamp?
Well, they do get stuck in a swamp, but I think when they go, there's a lot of people who went, with a sincere desire to help people. And when they do this, what they're doing is justifying it by what they've been taught. So they believe they can help the poor and, make peace in the world by advocating these things that they have been taught, and they're not into it for the money. And they may get trapped then into how to get that job done to be effective in Washington. The first thing they teach them is to become very dependent on the system in order to get on the right committee to do those good things or get promoted and become a chairman. But many of them, I would say that there's a lot of good intentions, but good intentions don't get us very far. But the people who really run the show, the people who are in control, I mean, if you wanted to be a speaker or wanted to be a chairman of a committee, they understand it very well what they're doing, and they know that. For instance, you might, I don't know what it is now, but to become a chairman of a big committee, you might have to raise $50,000-$100,000 for the party, and so you sort of purchase that, and then you have to go follow the party line. There was an individual I remember that was voting with the hardcore. There'd be four or five or six of us, voting pretty consistently against some of the spending. And all of a sudden, one day, the fellow that I knew, and we was a friend, I said, "Well, you didn't vote with us today." He said, "Oh, no." He says, "I've just joined leadership." He got a position on the whip team or something like that. He was moving up on the ladder. And for him, once you become a leader, what you do is you become the opposite of a leader. And I always thought that was funny. I didn't charge him because I didn't think it was worthwhile.
Well, speaking of party politics, I understand that you recorded a message for the folks at the Human Action Bash this past weekend in New Orleans, and you made reference to the Mises Caucus being a true spirit of the Libertarian Party. Apparently, the Libertarian Party wants to keep on keeping on with the party's decision to keep its leadership as chair. Do you think the LP is redeemable at this point?
Oh, I still hope some good will come of it. I am still technically a member. I didn't write a blistering letter and say I'm resigning from the Libertarian Party. I'm a lifetime member. But, they've drifted away, from using the party as an instrument to promote libertarian ideas. So that to me is disappointing. But who knows? Who might join and who might get involved, and they may improve. But in the last few go arounds with the national presidential races, they haven't done too well to promote our message.
Yeah, all right. I want to move on to a subject that it's in the forefront of the news now, and it has to do with the southern border. And I just wanted to ask if you were still on the Hill with. And this is taking into account there is no hope in sight of getting rid of the welfare state, abolishing it at all. What would be your solution right now to this conflict that's going on the southern border?
Yeah. Well, it's impossible to say that there's some short-term solution without looking at it philosophically and dealing with the causes. And it wasn't too long ago I came across somebody reproduced a interview that I had in 1988 when I was a Libertarian candidate, and it had to do with the borders. And lo and behold, my position back then was exactly like it is now. And I says, you can't deal with it unless you remove the incentives. You've already mentioned one big incentive is the welfare state, and also easy road to citizenship. So it's not going to be solved And then there's some libertarians who believe in totally open borders. And then there's others that don't quite buy into that because of the calamity it causes. But I can remember in 88 it coming up because I was still, you know, working on it. It wasn't nearly the problem it is today. I said, you know, I would like to have as open borders as possible. I think that's a good idea. But when does the open borders permit an invasion of the country? But I never quite dreamed it would be like what's going on now, especially in Europe. These are invasions, so this is a bit different. So I resort to trying to argue the principles of the private property. You know, I think if you had a libertarian island or a true society, I think it would be pretty closed because nobody could come on your property. Every individual, you can't come in here unless I invite you in. So it isn't automatically, you know, open borders in a libertarian society. So I think just like all the problems, whether it's the Federal Reserve, what am I going to do with the mess the Fed created? Well, it's not going to be easy because they've created a monster and it has to be resolved by liquidation. But I still think the most important thing is to study and learn and know what to do when the opportunity presents itself for sound money and a sound policy for immigration. I would like to see as much immigration as possible and lots of visas and people coming, but under the situation, you know, that you know, this idea of citizenship, which conveys so much of an advantage of one group over another, that I would not offer that up. I think that's a big problem. But if you wanted to think of an ideal way to handle borders, you could think, well, let's assume we have 50 countries, you know, instead of states dominated by the federal government. But if we had 50 countries that allowed travel and buying and selling across borders and agreed on a sound currency like gold, you know, it works pretty well, you know, but there's so many other factors. There's cultural factors and whatever. So, but I think of it, when I talk to libertarians, I think of it as a property issue. People who say, well, you are too tough. You're keeping people out and they need to come in. And they should be allowed to come in. And the welfare thing is a separate issue. I said, okay, all right, we have our house. And does that mean anybody could walk into your house? No, that's not what I mean. Well, what if you live in a condominium and you have condominium government and you have certain agreements? Would you let your people come in there and occupy? Oh, no, we wouldn't do that. But the problem is that the government's too much involved. The government owns too much land. They own our schools. They own our hospitals. They do everything. So there is no answer. No libertarian answer to a statist society. The only thing you can do is work for the answer in a different situation by undermining and getting rid of the statist society that we have, where the government owns everything, and if they don't own it, they control everything. So that's very difficult. But I think people have to think more as property. I do think it's once they walk in, it's much closer to walking into our house than most people want to realize, because we pay for everything. You might, on the condominium argument, you say, well, we don't want people to come into your condominium, but you know, you have a swimming pool area out there and you have extra room and your tennis courts. Don't you think that's a sort of a group ownership? Don't you think people should, you know, participate in that? No, I don't. It should be ownership. So private property ownership would solve a lot of these problems. But to say that there's a magical answer here, you know, I don't like fences, I don't like guns and lots of arrests and, you know, an authoritarian approach to this, but I would like to change it a whole lot. So I don't think anybody has the perfect answer, whether they're libertarians or authoritarians. I fear what so often is done in the name of, you know, rounding up immigrants. Quite frankly, there's a high percentage of those people who do come who are really good people and work hard and produce, but then there's a lot of what's going on in the cities now, and of course it's so much worse in Europe, but now just look at what our inner cities are like, and a lot of it involves migration. So I have no perfect answer for that other than what the ideal would be like if you lived in a libertarian society.
Okay. And I'm glad you talked about the economy, because I can't have you on and ask you questions unless I have a chance to ask a question about an economic question. When I look at recent history, especially the 2008 financial crisis, all I can see around the corner is another bubble popping soon. But this time, I believe it's going to be in multiple sectors, not just in the real estate sector. Leading up to the crisis in 2008, you were saying over and over again that a storm was coming. Do you see a tsunami approaching right now? And is there anything that really can be done about it?
I maintain that it's big, it's coming, and it's bigger than what we've had. And the only thing you can do about it, you can't prevent it. The bubbles come, from the Fed, the inflation, and the Q4s have produced conditions that have been extraordinary. They're unbelievable. So it's going to come. The only thing that can be done is personally, you have to be prepared. You have to be prepared if it gets way out of hand. If things drift over into conditions like in Venezuela, you better have to have plans. And also, there'll be, political chaos and safety for things to be dealing with. But I think what you're suggesting is probably right. It's not going to be just a housing bubble. I think it's going to be not so many different things, but one big thing. And the one big thing, I believe, will have to do with the monetary system and the challenge to the dollar system. The debts that we have, even though the dollar, maintains, a pretty good position when you compare it to the euro and other things, but the dollar, everything is dependent on the dollar. Eventually, though, and we're in the midst of a trade war, that may precipitate it. People may just start to abandon the dollar. When push comes to shove, there's going to be a lot of other people who have been accumulating gold. And there have been most people in the world resent the United States for our economic authoritarianism and our sanctions that we put on, as well as our foreign policy. And I think they're going to be very happy to come down hard on us. And that means the destruction of the dollar as the reserve standard of the world. And that can come as a calamity and happen very, very quickly and totally destructive. Or it can, just lose status over a period of time until something else replaces it, more or less how the British pound did it. I mean, it was the end of the British Empire, but it wasn't the end of the pound, but it was a transition. And I think that transition has already started. I think we're going to see it, but I believe that's the big bubble, and it to me would be the bond bubble. The bonds and the stocks, they're all artificially high. I understand that most of the stocks bought in this past year have been buybacks. And how did they buy them back? Well, they borrowed money for free from the Federal Reserve, that sort of thing. And they borrow money for free from the Federal Reserve, and then they buy treasury bills that pay them a percent higher than what they have to pay the government. It's just a totally out of control system. So the bubble is huge. It will burst. I think it's leaking right now. And I don't think people have with all the so-called statistics, everybody feels pretty good about it. So I just think that it's going to be a big surprise for a lot of people, except for that 40 or 50% that have been in depression, even in spite of this so-called recovery. Because I think that's part of the reasons why we have this social chaos right now, is that half of the people have already been pushed into a depressive position, and they're not feeling good about themselves, and they're barely making it. And that's why we see what's happening in San Francisco and LA and New York City, with thousands of homeless people in the midst of the great prosperity that we claim we have.
Yeah, I really hope people heed your warning on that, because it's coming, and it's going to be really, really ugly.
Yeah.
If you'll allow me one more question, I know we're short on time.
Okay.
Foreign policy, Korea, North Korea. If you were foreign policy advisor to Donald Trump, what would be your counsel on continuing relations with North Korea and the Kim family?
Well, I would keep doing it, but I'd probably announce the position that we have no desire to tell you what to do, and that we want to be friends, and we want to trade with you and communicate with you, and we're leaving the Korean Peninsula. That's up to the South Koreans and the North Koreans, and the Koreans want to talk to each other, and I would let them do it. I would just disengage, which would make the neocons hysterical, you know. You say, but he's a monster, and he has nuclear weapons. Maybe he has nuclear weapons. But I think the guy is sane. I think he knows that one drop of one small nuclear weapon by him, his whole country would be wiped off the map, and it could be by the Chinese or the Russians, Americans, or anybody. I mean, I just don't think the danger is there. Besides, why can't we talk to this guy when we talked to Mao Zedong and he had nuclear weapons and he was a thug, killed millions. And we talked to, you know, even Khrushchev and the rest of them over all those years with the Soviet system. They had a lot of nuclear weapons, this whole idea. And look at the time we, in a foreign policy, look at the time we spend, you know, agitating and demagoguing the danger of Iran about their nuclear weapon that they don't have, and that we were told 30 years ago they would have it within months. You know, it's just all based on lies and propaganda. North Korea is not going to invade United States, and if they sent a missile to any bit of property, they would be wiped off the map so fast. But I just think that disengagement, just leave. The war's over. It's been we've been there since I was in high school in 1950. It makes no sense. The South Korean people have spoken. They elected a president that wants to talk, and they're anxious to visit their relatives. I think that's what would happen. But the neocons are terrified that peace would break out. And this whole idea, I wished it were all true, that they're working and moving in that direction, but how can you trust Bolton and Pompeo? And they have spoken so clearly that you can't trust them. So I think that is already starting to back down. If even in this situation where there is intervention, I would tell Trump, you're going in the wrong direction. Get rid of those two guys. They're not your friends. If you want to have peace with North Korea, they're not going to give you a friend. They're going to undermine what you do, and they'll blame it all on North Korea. We've done it several times when the conditions, when the relationships break down, we always blame the other side for doing it. So, like, just Trump walking away from the Iran nuclear deal, it was all Iran's fault. They lived up to everything they said. So it's terrible. Non-interventionism is a wonderful position to hold, and it's we spend less money and we'd be much safer.
You do a daily show now called the Liberty Report. Can you just say a couple words about why people should be watching it?
Well, we do that. We just finished one. It's live streamed at 11 o'clock Central Time. And Daniel McAdams joins me frequently on this, and we talk a lot about foreign policy. Today I did one on, you know, the states of Arizona and Wyoming, you know, legalizing gold. Can you believe that? They legalize gold as money. So, and that's, of course, the issue of challenging the Federal Reserve's monopoly. So we do economic policy and foreign policy or whatever's in the news, and we try to be timely on this, and something that, you know, we're doing okay, but we're always looking for more visitors to our site, RonPaulLibertyReport.com.
Dr. Paul, I'm here because of your courage to say what needed to be said at one time, and I just really appreciate your time, and thank you for coming on today.
Great to be with you. Appreciate it.
Good day, Bye. Sir. I want to thank you for tuning in to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank Dr. Paul for coming on today. I want to remind you about my books, Freedom Through Memedom and The Kids Are Not All Right. Check them out on Amazon or on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com/store. And I look forward to coming back at you in the middle of the week with another podcast. So take care, have a great week, and bye.